All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers, what the fuck buddies, what the fucking ears, what the fucksters, what the fuckadelics? How many of those do I have to do? I'm on the road. I'm not in the country. Not that that has any bearing on how many of those silly names for WTF listeners that I come up with, but I'm out of the country. I'm out in the world. I was just in London. The last time I talked to you was when I was slightly nervous, maybe a bit full of anxiety and perhaps a little bit of dread about my London show at Royal Festival Hall, a large room down at the South Bank Center that seats about 2,500 or something. But I'm here to report, because I know a lot of you are like, I wonder how it went for Mark over there. I wonder how Mark's doing in that other country. It went great. Had a great show. Josie Long opened for me. She was spectacular. Then I went out there. I sat down and I had them. You know what the deal was? Not only was I good, and I don't toot my own horn often. I did what I do, but I was happy it went well. It was a great show. Everyone enjoyed it. People came from many different places around the countries here. But I think the trick was, and this is a rare bit of experience. Let me say before I go on much longer that a couple of things. Sam Tripoli is on the show today, and that's a handful. That's a lot to deal with. That was a lot for both of us, I think. That was Sam Tripoli is, you got to sort of strap in and hold on to the sides of the chair a little bit. But it was good. It was a long time coming. I see Sam a lot. He's one of those cats who I know from the Comedy Store. I've known him for many years now, actually. We don't hang out, but I know him. I remember when he was going through some trouble with the drinky. And, I've just seen him around. It was one of those things where I'm like, yeah, man, I got to have you on. And then it just finally happened years after the day I first said, you got to do the show. So Sam's on today. It was a good conversation. We travel some distances. He's a manic cat with some big ideas, some of them sort of twisted and gnarled that traverse the conspiracy arc. Yeah, we discussed that. I try to keep that out of my head by choice. But what if it's true, man? Maybe that it's the what if that bothers me. I mean, think about it, makes sense. I don't know. It think about it. What if? I got too much imagination for that shit. Do you understand what I'm saying? Maybe it's vague to you now. Perhaps it'll become clearer in a few minutes. So, London. Little lesson I learned, and this is for anybody who's going to be playing a space. This is for anybody who might be performing in a room that has a wall-sized pipe organ on it. I mean, like the entire wall. I'm going to say probably 50 feet across, 20, 30 feet high of just a pipe organ, just the pipes for a pipe organ. Now, and this is the rare thing, and it's a wisdom that I'm not complaining. I'm just throwing this out there. If you happen to play, say, Symphony Hall in San Francisco, you're going to be standing in front of a tremendous pipe organ. And I thought that show was good a couple years ago, but I didn't love it. I didn't feel like I felt dwarfed by the organ. I felt dwarfed by the expectations of the space, which I was projecting, obviously. A space is a space, but I believe that space was accustomed to, woodwinds and whatnot, which is going to be the name of some musician's memoir. But here, when I was in London, I'm now in, I'm in Sweden. I'm in Stockholm. Coming into the city, I wasn't like, wow, this is something. But now I'm like, yeah, it is. It's its own thing. It's charming. Architecture is interesting. The words are very funny. And I don't mean that in an insensitive way or a condescending way or a stupid American way. But I saw a word on a billboard, and maybe I'm immature, but if I see the word F-A-R-T-E-N, I'm going to laugh a little, because that says farting. How can you not laugh a little? Are you laughing a little in your car? It just said farting, and it had the umlaut somewhere. But I like it, and I see boats. So, pipe organs. My advice to you is that if you have the option to have them drop a curtain in front of the wall of pipe organ, I would do that. I did that in London, and I think it made a big difference. Maybe not, but I did make the decision. I had the decision to make, and from my experience at Symphony Hall, my innate gut feeling that I'm being dwarfed by the possibility of that making noise that people would want to hear, I chose against it, and I feel like it helped my mind, and I think it helped the comedy, and I was able to pull the people in, make it an intimate space. So that show went great, and last night we went to Sarah the Painter's opening at Timothy Taylor Gallery in London in the Mayfair area, swanky, and that show was great. A lot of people came, a few weirdos, but you know, that's to be expected. Art can be of any kind, can be sort of like one of those, like a light to a light, like moths, like weirdo moths. Art brings people. But the show was great. Great response. Went out to an amazing dinner. I think it was a 27-course meal at a Peruvian restaurant. Didn't eat today, and I felt like I wanted to die last night because I really felt like this was it. I just have to stop doing that. Eating. But the art was great. The response was great. If you are in London, you can go see the show for a couple months, I think, at Timothy Taylor Gallery. There's a nice hearty plug for my... what do we say now? I say girlfriend. Who says partner? Anybody? Partner? Don't like it. I don't like it. So I'm in Sweden, and if you're listening to this on Thursday and you're in Stockholm or nearby in one of the umlauted suburbs, Thursday, that's today, night, I'm performing here in Stockholm. I'll tell you, this is like probably the fourth or fifth time. Oh, did I mention the Glow? Back on the air, June 29th, man. Women, people. So that's happening. What was I talking about? Oh, I was saying that I'm enjoying being out of the country. It's relaxing to be out of America and the sort of chaotic pace of what you put in your head on that continent. I know things aren't great in London, but it was great to be there because their problems weren't exactly my problems or our problems or the national problems that we experience in the States. It's a relief. It's really a relief to be way up here in Sweden because I feel like I'm way far away, and I can feel that. I can feel the ease of my mind in the back of my neck. I'm not being strangled by the day's news and the constant chaos and possibility of systemic breakdown, both me personally and the country. So it is relaxing. I realized the other day when I was in London and also before I left, I don't know if I had time, but I know some people are probably and were expecting me to talk about the death of Mitzi Shore, the owner and really the life source and overseer and creator of the Comedy Store. She passed away last week, and I didn't mention it. I mentioned it on Twitter in one of my rare tweets, but she had a profound impact on my life. I can't say that I knew her. I don't know who did in recent years. I am going to be running an episode shortly with Eleanor Kerrigan, who's a comedian and was a waitress at the store and was sort of Mitzi's assistant for a while. We've talked a lot about Mitzi on this show. She definitely, as I said, that place and her. A lot of people, you know, talk to me. They ask me questions about the Comedy Store or about Mitzi. Like, you know, you must be sad or you probably, you know, are going to miss her or whatever. I didn't know her. I worked at the Comedy Store. I was there years ago and she was around, but I didn't know her then. They talk about the place and her like, you know, like it's a normal situation. Like this was a normal person or that comedians of that era and some now are living normal lives. I mean, that place was this very magical, dark, mystical castle for me. And I was out of my mind. And she was the queen of like a mythological universe that had complete power over my head and the head of many comics. It was outside of Hollywood. It was outside the realms of show business. It was its own planet, the Comedy Store. And she was the reigning deity. Some of the older guys knew her better. Some people had relationships with her, but I was there shortly when she was cognizant. I was there for a little under a year. And, you know, any exchange I had with her, you know, was deeply meaningful. You just ran around being, you know, afraid of running into her. And if you did, just hoping that she liked you and hoping she didn't take away your spots or tell you you couldn't work there anymore or won't let you work the door. You used to worry about not being able to do your door shift because you pissed her off. But you always thought she had the answers, the comedic answers. She would give notes sometimes. And I've told this story many times before I got all fucked up on drugs. And I was just a hungry, wide-eyed, slightly drugged up, aggravated Jewish kid who had come in from New Mexico. She did see me do comedy, and you just really want her to say something to you. And as some of you know, you've heard this story. She said, "You're a poet. You should wear a scarf on stage." I'm barely doing a good Mitzi impression. "You're a poet. You should wear a scarf on stage." And I was like, "Thank you. Thank you, Mitzi." And I did. I found a scarf. I wore it a bit. I think I have pictures of me on it. I promise you, if I find the pictures of me wearing a scarf at the Comedy Store on Mitzi's recommendation, I will share them on my social media platforms. So, rest in peace, Mitzi Shore. You changed a lot of lives, for better or for worse. I will throw that in. I will. Sam Tripoli is a unique person, a funny person, very funny. Live Wire, happy to have him here. I talked to him, and it's actually another one of the old garage interviews. You can check out his podcasts, Punch Drunk Sports and Tinfoil Hat with Sam Tripoli. Also, get his stand-up dates at samtripoli.com. This is me and the Sam Tripoli back in the old garage. How long have you lived here?
In Los Angeles, I've been here since I think 2000.
Really?
Yeah.
So it's a long time already, huh?
It flies though, dude. It seems like yesterday.
Does it?
It seems like five years equals 1 year to me. I don't know why, but it just seems. Maybe it's not three or four years, but
it's just true. Yeah, the last 10 have gone by kind of,
and it goes really right. Well, and you're expecting these things to happen, and they just. It just blends and it just goes, and next thing you know, you are where you are.
Yeah, yeah. The thing doesn't happen.
It does happen. It doesn't happen. Yeah, or a different thing, like different what thing you wanted to happen.
All of a sudden, 10 years down the line, you're like, I did a lot of shit.
Yeah.
It means something.
I mean, just think about when you started this that we're doing right now, how like this really didn't exist. Like this medium of podcasting wasn't really there.
Right.
I always had this theory, like, what if you were the greatest at something that's didn't never exist. Been invented yet?
Yeah.
Like you are the greatest at
before
time travel, hide and go seek. You can hide better than any other time. You know, you
I'm
but
great.
It hasn't been invented
I'm great
yet.
At disappearing into Nazi Germany.
Yeah.
When the game started in caveman times.
Yeah. Yeah. So it doesn't exist. But here's this medium that showed up and now you've met. Mastered it.
Yeah. Well, I guess if it's the ahead of your time thing, that if you're ahead of your time and they don't have the resources, you're just a weirdo.
By the way, you never want to be the first guy in the trailblazer.
Yeah.
That guy usually dies a horrible death in obscurity.
Right.
Yeah, it's exactly. The third dude who comes in and collects all the glory,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, exactly. There's always the genius behind the guy that makes it.
Yeah.
The sad genius.
It's like Friendster. That dude's got to be on suicide patrol all the time.
I have no idea what happened to that dude.
Where is that guy?
I remember everybody was worked up about Friendster. That was really the first one.
Yeah.
And I remember when I got here in 2002, I had to get on there.
Yeah.
And I got on there and I didn't understand the point of it. And then there's someone started imitating me. I had a fake account.
Oh, that's
someone
how you know you made it.
Pretending to be me. But that was 2002. I hadn't made it. And I freaked out and I got a friend who's a lawyer and I got her involved in it. And shut the guy. It was that like, I was like, what the fuck is happening?
Yeah.
Now it happens. You're like, oh, this guy, another annoying asshole.
Good for him.
Yeah.
Hope he doesn't get more popular than me. I've always wanted to start a fake profile account called Alternative Sam and just see who could get bigger.
Why haven't you done it?
Because I do a conspiracy podcast.
You do?
I love it, dude. I have such a great time
doing it. What's that called?
Tinfoil Hat with Sam Tripoli.
When did you start that?
The version of it now started last March.
Yeah. And how's it going?
I mean, like, For me, it's doing great numbers, you know. For what's, you, you probably cry like, what's wrong with
my
life?
What's the angle? Yeah, what happened? Where did I go wrong?
Why are we down to 50,000? But it's great. I just enjoy, I've always been into it. Do you know when I started believing in conspiracies, dude?
I was sort of engaged with conspiracies back in the day, and I've pulled out. So, yeah, I want to know, when did you start?
When they discovered the Iron Sheik and Hacksaw Jim Duggan drunk in a car together,
yeah.
And I was a huge wrestling fan,
yeah.
And I'm like, there's fucking, that's bullshit. Why are they hanging out together? They're supposed to be, he's a hero, he's a terrorist, and they're shit-faced, and I swear to God, that's when I go, oh, man.
It's all true. The Jews run the world.
The Jews don't run the world. Luciferians run the world.
Luciferians.
Yeah, but they listen.
There's no Jewish Luciferians.
I fight anti-Semitism all the time. My girlfriend's Jewish, her family's all Hebrews, love them all.
Hebrews, yeah.
The Hebrews, what do we call it? What's
sure.
It? If I call them Jews?
I don't care what you call them.
You know? And I
prefer
every time,
fucking Jews.
Yeah, I love fucking. I do love Jews. I'll watch Israeli fucking twerk videos all day, dog. Of Israeli troops twerking, they're fucking wonderful.
But wait, who are the Luciferians?
Well, it's my opinion that there is a group of people out there that use religion as kind of masks to walk amongst us.
Yeah.
So they'll be like, oh, I'm a Jewish, I'm Muslims, I'm all that, when really they're not, and they're into these, whatever you want to call them, dark art shit.
Yeah.
And and that's really who runs everything. It's like there's these dark arts people who use this fucking really dark shit to do stuff.
Do we know any of them? Are there? Have you named any of the dark arts folks?
There's, you know,
or are they just nebulous? They're just around us.
No, there's like the Rothschilds, and I hear that. But then the House of Saud, they're in on it. Then I found out about this like really old ancient banking group from Italy that are now Muslims. So there's like Muslims. There's Hebrew. Then the Vatican's really dark into the whole shit.
So you've really done your homework on this.
I read it and watch it and look at it all day.
But do you ever study legitimate history,
such as?
Well, I mean, do you put this stuff into context? Or is it, do you just,
I think
kinda,
that's the only way you could study
you
this
just
stuff.
Cherry pick this stuff and
no,
connect
I don't believe
the
it
dots.
All. Like, what would be your real history that you think I should look into?
No, what I'm saying is that, the secret societies and the banking families,
yes,
and that was a real thing.
Right.
You know, whether or not the torch has been passed in the exact same way through weird coded sacrifices or rituals. I don't. That's where it gets a little dicey. That, you know, over generations and centuries, that you're saying
it's a long game they play. It's not necessary, and it sounds crazy, but it's a long game. It's a long game.
But you don't. What I'm saying is that hasn't the control of large chunks of money and property always been by the few in small rooms,
right?
With or without hats,
right?
What? Right.
Right. Probably.
So what I'm saying is does it have
to
be?
No, they have hats for sure.
Okay. So what I'm saying is is it always necessarily shrouded in mystery and ritual as opposed to just people, you know, doing what is necessary to hold on to massive wealth, which is usually owning politicians, owning armies, owning whatever.
Okay. That's a great point. You're like, isn't this just human nature?
Well, no, it's like we know who they are.
Right.
They're not hiding.
But I think people are hiding, though.
Well, you
and
go
that's
to that big
thing.
G8 or whatever it is. I know about the Bilderbergers and the Freemasons and the Illuminati and the Trilateral Commission
and
the Kissinger and the Rothschilds and the Rockefellers and the, you know, whatever.
For sure.
Sure. I mean, I know about it as much as I know about it.
Right.
Do you know what I mean? Like,
right.
I know about 33-degree masonry.
Right.
I get it. You know, but like, you know, like sometimes you got to be careful in this day and age we live in. You know, conspiracy theories are a way for stupid people to seem smart and for uninformed people to get all worked up about stuff that might be bullshit. And then they kind of sacrifice their mental disposition to negative forces who may be working at behest of the conspiracies.
Okay, I get what you're saying.
And I'm not calling
right
you
there.
Stupid.
No, for a moment there, I was like, who is he talking about? I did flunk first grade, but that's fine.
That doesn't count.
You know, here's the thing. You're totally right. You're totally in on. You're totally correct. It's like maybe this is human nature. Maybe this has all existed. But for me, it's like, What is the truth, though? It's like,
right.
Is it this weird shit that you go on a Reddit, you do this information?
Well, that's what I'm saying. I don't think it's human nature. I think it's how power works.
Right.
So it's not essentially human nature. It's, you know, however civilization was put together and who put that together and however far you want to go back.
Right, whatever the legacy
of those original masons were, or whatever. Right. Did you ever see The Man Who Would Be King?
Yeah.
Right. So... Yeah, that's one of those like trippy. That's a great conspiracy movie.
I totally agree with what you're saying. Let's take this the Iraq War of early in the 2000s, right? This is all I'm talking about,
right.
And this is will sum up exactly what I'm talking about. So we have this Iraq War. We are told of these weapons of mass destruction, which later on we find out is not true. And then Wesley Clark has that video where he talks about, you know, sometimes if you're a hammer, everything's a nail, stuff like that. And he lists all these countries, right?
Right.
And then you kind of do a little more research and you go, oh, all those countries also don't have centralized banks. And now after those groups, there's down to three of them that don't no longer have centralized banks. To me, that's what I find interesting. Is there a darker motive to what we're being told is going on?
Oh, so you're saying the global banking cabal through the Cheney cult was making their move.
Well, I mean, you
know. No, I'm not. I mean, I'm just.
Right. That to me, I find interesting.
Sure.
It's what I like to interview. Like, is there another motive? Is there a darker
motive?
Other
than money?
Other than money, power, and everything, but the sale of patriotism.
Oh, right.
And
well, propaganda.
Us,
right.
Yeah. And us having to be like, oh, man, we got to do this because it's a threat to us. And you have these hillbillies. It go, America, you're going to fuck with America. You hit us and all this shit.
Right. And they've just been sold out. They've been taken advantage of. That happens.
That interests me.
Well, yeah. Well, that's just dirty politics.
That's fine. Then that's what I'm into. I love
knowing the truth.
And I'm not going to sit there like, we're going to change it or
follow
stop
the money.
It. I just like to know about it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, yeah, I mean that, but that's not so much conspiracy as it is that, you know, that it was a massive propaganda push to do a cash grab and just gut Iraq. And
but all a conspiracy is two people conspiring to do something. And that to me is like, if 9/11 is an inside job, and that's a whole different conversation, if it is an inside job, there's a conspiracy there. And I enjoy looking into that and unboxing
independent speculative investigators. Yeah, that's what I used to call them.
I love it.
Sure. All right. Well, as long as it's a fun hobby for you.
It does. My
problem is that you know, you have two, you know, information realities. And, you know, if the propaganda is strong enough, which, you know, and has the right outlets, and now that everything is bubble land and people can live in bubbles, is that, you know, what you have, the real problem becomes right now is that the truth becomes unstable. And people who maybe think along your lines go like, well, who's to say what the truth is? It's like, well, there is truth. And it can be assessed.
Okay.
But, you know, like if you'd rather believe that Hillary Clinton is part of a satanic child molesting cult and you're pretty goddamn sure it's centered at a pizza place in D.C. and has to do with her chief of staff.
Okay.
Then like, maybe we should investigate a little further before you just buy that shit hook, line, and sinker and maybe think that maybe someone might be fucking with your head with an agenda.
Okay, I get what you're saying about that.
But
so is it the pizza parlor that drives you crazy in that story? Because that's always what it is. They're like, okay, sun's going down the pizza parlor. If you took a little time, because it's only speculative and just jumping in and mouthing off.
Yeah.
Because from your perspective,
yeah,
you haven't been investigating it. It's not because you're a busy man. You had your show going.
But where is the information coming from that you're investigating?
I'm telling you.
You know that there are shit mills churning out garbage all day long for vulnerable people who think they're onto something to drag them into a certain way of thinking.
I can completely understand what you're saying about that, Mark. But if let's say, let's take that part away, right?
Right.
Let's take the Hillary, that part. Now, listen, man. Mark, you've known me. Granted, we don't hang out all the time.
Yeah.
We're passing ships in the night.
Sure, sure.
You know, but for the most part, I would say that our interaction is pleasant, and I've always been treated you well. Never been an asshole.
Yeah.
All that.
Yeah,
shit.
Yeah, no, I feel like we get
you
along.
You and I
yeah.
You know,
no
I
doubt.
Would say you're like, hey, is Sam a good guy? I would say for the most part, you'd be like, oh, he's a good guy. I don't know him. At, you know. Really super close, but in my interactions with him, it's been really well.
Yeah,
you know,
he seems to like being a little off in his head.
He's a little crazy. People talks to himself a lot in the bathroom. Don't know why.
Doing a lot of research.
Yeah, doing a lot of research. But it's very interesting that, you know, like, and maybe it's not you. Let's say somebody else at the Comedy Store,
all right,
who is a good friend of mine, thinks I'm a crazy person, yet these people that they see on television that they don't even know at all.
Yeah.
They would take their word over that over myself. Whereas I'm doing all this research independently on my own.
Yeah.
A lot, you know, extensively.
Well, I'm just happy that you're not doing it on meth.
Yeah.
And well, that, you know, you haven't ruined your relationship yet.
My whole thing is that I just love studying it. Uh-huh. I study history right. up to this point and use that history to project what I think. And at the end of the day, it is what it is. And sure. if there is any sort of thought that maybe this is real, I just don't know why people don't investigate it and just do a real investigation on it.
Right. But that, you know, but real investigating in the age we live in now, you know, in where you get that information,
right.
you know, what the outlets are, how is it sourced? You know, like, you know, do documents, hey, they looked real and, you know, this is an arrest record from wherever. But, you know, to actually do reporting and get out into the dirt and go look at public records and that stuff on your own, that's impressive.
Yeah.
But, you know, just to sort of like, you know, collect things from different sites that are purveying information.
But why is that what's going on? Why? And this is totally fine. You know, it's like, why is the notion that someone like a Wolf Blitzer is giving out information?
He's not a reporter. Right. I mean, you know, it's like, you know, you just have to believe that, you know, most of the time they're sourcing their work. Yeah. I mean,
We are talking propaganda, right? Isn't that kind of what I've been talking about? It's propaganda.
Sure, sure, sure.
Whether you're talking about it's politics or music or whatever, I'm all about, do you play ball? That's to me, it's the initiation. Whoever we're talking about, whether it's in politics or in the music
industry. But who's the player?
Who plays ball?
Are you saying the consumer, me or you?
No. The artist or the politician. Oh, they play ball? Do they play ball with the powers that be and what they want put out?
Well, yeah, I mean, but are you hip to the sort of L. Ron Hubbard, the rocket scientist guy?
Yes.
You got that one going?
And then, you know, the Laurel Canyon studio, which was a very, you know, like Jim Morrison's dad was involved very high up.
Oh, the general?
The general.
Yeah.
Gulf of Tonkin.
All right, so you're going full out. Yeah, good. Have a good time.
And listen, man, it's not that like I'm like, we got to do it, you know, and I'm throwing a tin foil hat. I just love knowing about it.
Yeah, no, I have the books. I've read the stuff. I was in the hole. You know, I mean, if you can manage it and
it's
you
great.
Can. Well, good. You know, I got to a point where it's sort of like I need to ground myself in something tangible in my own life and something true and not indulgent. You know, not true in the way that, you know, that stuff's all very compelling.
I love it.
Connect the dots. Right. But what I start to fear in talking about it is like, are we diminishing or detracting from a clearer narrative about what's really happening?
Okay. I understand what you're saying. I think that our ability to keep the eye on the ball affects the rest of the world.
Who's me and you?
No, me, you, all your listeners, everybody who lives in this.
The eye on the ball.
The eye on the ball. We are.
And what, who's playing ball?
Well, okay. So how many wars are we in right now? 5, 6? How many of them are approved by Congress? 2? And now we're thinking about going North Korea, Venezuela. Like, our number is getting up to 8. 8 people.
Yeah, it's a whole business unto itself. And okay. we're just being distracted by bullshit.
We're getting into Hitler numbers, okay, of people we've invaded. To me, all under the pretense that we're bringing freedom, democracy to people, when I think we bring a lot of chaos and destruction.
That's not even the pretense anymore. With this guy, they've outwardly said that is not our agenda anymore. We're going to close down the State Department. Who are we to impose democracy on these nice men who kill their own people?
I think if you think one's at that highest level, if you think one side is good, one side's bad,
it's not bad. I'm not saying good or bad. I'm saying there's a policy change that spreading democracy.
There
is
no
longer
outward policy change, an open policy change. I think the problems between the D's and the R's is that one group can be more honest with what they're doing, and the other one has to do it behind the thing because they're playing to a base that's about inclusion, love, equality, everybody getting the love, there's enough for everybody, let's all work together.
Yeah.
And behind closed doors, they can't do that because that is not what is going on. Like, what they're calling out Trump right now on the Russia stuff, to me, they have to have that because what they would call him out on real shit, which is war, spying, all that stuff, is what you could say about any president before him and the people above him. I just personally think we went from two wars to five wars under Obama. We're going to go to five wars to seven wars, probably under Trump. And I just think that we're doing bad shit to the rest of the world because we are too busy on our phones or we don't want to be investigate this and we're spread thin and we're so busy that we just want to know what's going on. So we turn on the tube and somebody like Rachel Maddow or somebody like Wolf Blitzer or Sean Hannity tells us something and we want to believe it's true because one, a lot of people have children. Two, we're too busy and we don't want to believe that we're part of this fucking empire shit. And that's just my kind of opinion. So I love.
Well, yeah, no, I think that part of that is true. And I think that, yeah, I think that people are distracted and finding the real information is difficult. And people, a lot of people aren't interested if it doesn't affect their life directly.
Yeah.
I think that, you know, this country usually functions by enough people being okay to not question. And, you know, I agree with that. But I do believe that, you know, you can, like you, and I think you're basically saying this, that if you find your sources and you believe your sources and you think that they are justified and doing real work, then you know those are the sources you're going to choose.
I love well I, for me it's like study history to see human behavior, how people react and how people act, what they're looking for, whether they want, whether their goals.
Yeah.
And then as you move forward, apply to what you've learned. Does this fit human nature? Does this fit how people have acted in the past that have been in the same position, their goals and what they want? Does this make sense? And that's all I kind of do is like follow, use the past to prove the future. And that's kind of what I do.
Okay. So that's your job. You're a prophet.
It's not a prophet. It's just like, I can't get this. I just enjoy studying it. I have no pretense.
When did you start? Like, where'd you, like, let's go back. So what did you study in college?
Mark, for me, man, I've wanted to be a stand-up comic from the moment I knew I existed. I didn't know it was a job.
Where'd you grow up?
Upstate New York.
Upstate? Like what
outside
part?
Outside Syracuse, a place called Cortland, New York, the 607.
Really?
And I wasn't good at anything.
Big family?
Me, my brother, my mother, my father. My brother was the number one high school bowler in New York State.
Bowler?
Yeah, he could bowl 300s with both hands, which where I'm from, that's water walking shit. Yeah. Like, that's some rock and bowl Jesus stuff.
Yeah, does he still bowl?
No, he gave it up. I don't know what it was. I think my brother got everything so quickly that he kind of was over it.
Yeah.
You know, so
he just quit bowling. Not even for fun.
The best I've ever seen, dude. I mean, could take his hand, either hand, throw a ball out, get a strike. He was a 15-year-old man who was idolized by 40-year-olds just because he was that good at bowling. He was just great at it.
And at some point, he just turned his back on it.
He got a full ride at Wichita State. Never took it. Yeah. Never took it.
I didn't even know that was an option at college where you get bowling scholarship.
Yeah, bowling's a big deal, dude.
It is?
It is, still, man. Think about it, dude.
I'm thinking about it.
If you think about the NBA, the NFL, all that stuff, like there is a small group of people that can actually get those jobs.
Right.
If you're a bowler, if you work hard.
If they're willing to play ball.
Yeah, if they're willing to play ball. There you go, dude. If you're a bowler, you're up against the population. Everybody can bowl. And everybody can go for it.
Sure.
Just didn't want to do it, man.
Huh.
But for me,
what'd he end up doing?
Running strip bars. You know,
Really?
Yeah, my mom hooked up with my dad, who was what they were called slicker back in the day. You remember the Outsiders?
Yeah.
All those slickers, that was my dad growing up, and my mom was a police officer's daughter, like the bad boy, put out two knucklehead kids, man. And you know,
What'd your dad do?
My dad gave me two things, man. Yeah. My sense of humor and a work ethic.
Yeah.
He worked really hard. My dad had a bunch of jobs. He owned property, was a teacher, was a real estate agent. Like, I just always watched him work hard.
Yeah, yeah.
Work hard, man. And I kind of gleaned that from
him. And your mom?
Teacher.
Yeah.
She taught. They were both teachers, man, you know. So I grew up and from the moment I knew I existed, I wanted to be a comic. And I remember getting funniest guy in sixth grade. And I'm the only person who ever went into high school. Maybe I wasn't, but I only cared about being class clown.
What kind of name is Tripoli?
It's Italian, but I'm half Armenian, half Italian.
Armenian on which side?
On my mother's side, Bedourians.
Bedourians?
Yeah.
Did you have a lot of Armenian family?
I had a lot of Armenian family.
They lived in the neighborhood?
They lived in Niagara Falls. There was a big Armenian community. For some reason, my grandmother never passed on Armenian language to my mother, or she did, but they never passed on to me. They were from a different generation.
Yeah.
Where they basically, it was about assimilation. instead of sure. now where it's kind of like niche, you know, carve your niche and stay.
Yeah, so, you want everyone wanted to pass.
Yeah, everybody wanted to be an be American, you right. know, and a lot of people who had the Tripoli last name changed their name to like Triple or something like that. Whereas my family Trippy. Kept their Trippy or something like that, and my family stayed with Tripoli.
Yeah. But the Armenians, what's the religion of the Armenians?
Christian. We were the first country to ever adopt Christianity as its national religion.
Armenia.
And it's very interesting because for about 16 years, I've been doing a giant event at the Comedy Store in the main room.
Yeah.
A cousin of mine, Alik, got a bone marrow cancer and they couldn't find a match for her.
Is Armenian guy?
Yeah, Armenian woman. Lady. She's going to be a doctor.
Right.
And then she couldn't find a match because Armenians have a very unique genetic makeup.
Uh-huh.
And it's basically because Armenia is surrounded by Muslim countries,
uh-huh.
and there was no interaction.
Uh-huh.
So Armenians, which is this very tiny area, just hooked up with other Armenians.
Yeah.
So basically, we're the hillbillies.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of
So you're saying there was a lot of cross-pollination,
Or not cross-pollination, hooking up with our own.
But that happens. But did they pace it out right, at least? Or were there someone in charge of, not your cousin, you know? Are there genetic problems?
Yeah, that's why it's hard to find.
But that's just a specific genetic type. Are you saying that there's a genetic weakness across the board?
Yeah, within Armenians, which is why they have
cancer?
To do these.
Yeah.
They started this, Dr. Frida Jordan and my cousin started, my cousin Michelle Topalian started the Armenian Bone Marrow Registry. And I got picked up at the Comedy Store, I think about 2000. And then 3 or 4 years later, I found out my cousin had bone marrow cancer. And I go, how can I help? And they're like, well, could you help us raise money? And so I put this huge event on in the main room. It's probably the oldest running show there, even though it's only once a year. It's the oldest running show. And we sell it out every year.
Yeah.
And they raise money. And it's with this weird charity where you can actually see the fruits of your labor. Meaning, sometimes I'll do charity events. I'm hope that money gets to whoever needs it.
Right.
But
you don't
know. Build a giant facility in Armenia. They've had a bunch of connects where these people connected with someone with their blood type and bone marrow type. And so it's been pretty cool, man.
That's great.
Yeah.
Doing good in the world.
I try. I call it my karma shell.
Good.
And for a while, everybody who did it, I could see who was going to blow up. They do it. And all of a sudden, boom, they became huge.
Oh, is that true?
Yeah. Whitney Cummings did it, blew up. El Magical did it, got picked up as a regular at the Comedy Store.
So you think it's the magic of your show?
I think it's just my vision, Doc. No, I just luck.
We're all going to find out by the end of this podcast that Sam Tripoli is secretly running everything.
Yes!
He's running
the pyramid scheme. It's
all
of it. Me
all
and then
it.
Queen Elizabeth.
He's at the top. He's right up there with the Bilderbergers. He's the one above the 1%.
Dude,
Sam
Tripoli.
Dude,
there's snipers everywhere around
sure,
here.
Buddy.
The blocks
Yeah, but you don't see him. That's how fucking deep state you are.
Yeah, they're shapeshifters, dude.
Yeah, shapeshifters are protecting Sam as he moves through.
My podcast is loved by the reptilians, dude.
Sure, the reptilians. That's, pull up those masks, fellas. We want to see what's underneath.
I'm super excited to be on.
Are you?
Yeah, man.
So, all right.
I feel like you've had everybody but me. I feel like you just had the dishwasher from the Comedy Store on.
What is that? I can get him on. Can you text him?
Yeah, he's it. Juan, get down here.
I don't know. You fell through the cracks. I don't know what happened.
I guess I'm a crazy person.
No. There's other people.
I get it.
Yeah, but I think all right, so let's go back, though. So you grew up in upstate.
Yeah.
Your brother gives up bowling. The family's can't understand it.
Yeah, nobody can.
He just went out, and then for for years, he was just in Siberia, or just didn't know what the hell he's going to do.
He is a rolling stone.
Yeah.
He just loves to move around and do his own thing.
Yeah.
You know, neither of us had kids, so I feel bad for my mom, and sometimes I get frustrated, have a kid for her, And,
is he married?
No, he just likes to roam, dude.
And he manages strip clubs.
He manages strip clubs. He kind of flips them. His job is to go into ones aren't doing well and flip them.
Oh, so he's a strip club wizard.
Yeah, strip club wizard. Yeah, dude, for sure.
And you, when you graduated high school, you didn't have a plan? What'd you do?
I wanted to be a stand-up.
I get it, but did you go to college or anything?
I went to UNLV. I thought, basically, it's very funny. My father, over time, worked me in convincing me I should move to Vegas. Because he's like, yeah, you should go to school out in Vegas. Go to Vegas. Vegas, great. I'm like,
because you wanted to be a comic?
Because I wanted to be a con, I thought it'd be a great place to start. I don't know why, but you'd always hear people like, yeah, sure. Oh, he's playing Vegas. You know, all the greats play. I'm like, oh, I'll go to Vegas. And right. Like my father was pushing me. And little did I know, they wanted to go out there and buy a house that I would like rent out, and they could use it as a business expense to go gamble all the time.
That was his plan?
He had a long game, dog. A long game, right? And that's all he does now. He lives in Prescott, Arizona. He gambles all day, and he calls me from the office. This is the Indian casino he's at, and he lives a life.
Where's your mom?
My mom still lives in Cortland. My dad lives in upstate New York.
So he split.
Yeah, they split up, and me, like the day after my brother graduated high school and left for Arizona to go to ASU, my mom was like, boom, get out, dude. and my poor father just wandered, and then...
Well, why? Was he like a pain in the ass the whole way through? Was he a gambling, sick gambler?
I think my father, you know, my father is like 75, I think, right now. You know, he's from that generation where you just get married, have kids, and, you know, and it's just like, he's not that, he didn't want to do that. I think he just wanted to be like like my brother, a Rolling Stone, just like go live his life, have fun, bang chicks and, you know, party and all that stuff. Yeah. But that wasn't what you did back then, you know? Yeah. Like then it was like get married, have kids. And
there were always people that did that.
I think they were. And I think my dad did that on the side.
Right.
I don't think he was perfect.
Right.
And you know, like when my parents got my divorce, my dad jumped all right into it. I mean, my brother jumped in the middle of it, was like trying to, you know, sell things. And I'm like, nah, dude, I don't want to know any of it. Yeah. I love you both. Get it over with. Get divorced. I don't want to know. Because I love my dad to death. I knew he was a shady motherfucker. You know what I'm saying? I just didn't need to know about it because I didn't want my dad not to be in my life. So I'm like, he's not perfect. And as you grow older as a man, because you know, you see, you love your mom. You grow up, that's your mom.
Yeah.
You do anything for your mother.
I don't know. Both of them are draining to me.
Really? But at no point when you were a really young kid, did you just not love your mom with all your heart?
No, I don't think we had the same situation.
And that's definitely true. But I feel like for me, I love my mom with all my heart.
Sure.
And my dad was like, oh, this is my dad. Be nice to mom, you know?
Right.
And then you grow older and you start interacting with women in your own life. And you're like, oh, now I get what dad was talking about.
Yeah,
dude.
Yeah.
These chicks are fucking crazy. And they're not perfect and I'm not perfect.
So you think your mom was fucking crazy?
No, my mom's one of the most loving people, but I know interacting with a woman, no matter how nice they are, there's one guy that's just like tired of hearing about it. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, no, everyone's got their troubles. So you're saying to me, you know, not all women are crazy, but the relationships
are
difficult.
No women are crazy. Everybody's crazy.
That's right. So, but I'm not just trying to correct it for the sake of being correct. Is this that like I tend to do that? You know, I tend to be like she was crazy, and you know, she's got problems. I got problems,
and
the problems
all nuts.
You know, they work for a while. Hey, isn't this fun? We're both fucked up, and then somebody's got to pull out. Somebody got to pull out.
Right,
because we're going down.
Yeah,
the plane's going down. Someone's got to eject.
Now, my girlfriend, who I love with all my heart, is a ride or die bitch. You know what I'm saying? Like, she's been through. You know, it's like my partying and all that shit. You know, she's been through all that. She's a great person. She drives me fucking nuts, but she's a great person. You know,
you've been with her that long?
15 years.
Wow.
Yeah.
But I think the point is that's interesting is that, you know, whoever you demonize growing up or whatever, you know, that you're choosing to draw a line with how much you really wanted to know about your old man just so, you know, you didn't take sides or you know, not have a relationship with him, that you're realizing as you get older, it's like, all right, I understand a little bit more, not just because, not as some outside observer, but you've got him in you.
Yeah. Oh. Dude, 100%. There was a point in my life where I go, oh man, I'm turning into my old man.
Yeah.
And I
what were you doing? Were you the stripper? Were you gambling?
No, it was this notion that everybody was jealous of me and holding me back from success. And there, you know, that weird moment you have where it's like
paranoia.
This paranoia that was instilled in me as a child, you know, from my dad all the time.
What do you think?
He's like, oh, these guys hate me because I'm doing this so well. I'm killing it. And everybody hates me. And like, I remember hearing that over and over. I'm like, man, you got to get along with people. I remember thinking as a kid, because some of our neighbors wanted to work with my dad on a real estate project. Yeah. And he was like, I don't know. I'm like, dad, you have to work with people.
Yeah.
So then, you know.
He thought everyone was out to fuck him?
Yeah. Huh. And they were all jealous of his fucking, of how
he's doing.
What? of his success and his ability
was
to do shit.
Was he successful?
He was a great real estate agent. Oh. My dad was, like I said, a super hustler, like
so
in a small
market.
So
it was hyper-competitive.
Super competitive. Yeah, yeah. And he got, and I would talk, I talked to him later about that, and he goes, well, that was my father.
Yeah.
My father was like that too.
And sure, he installed keeps going.
It, and it's just this weird cycle of life. Well, through me, you know, my life, I've gone through stints where I had to look at myself and be like, why is this happen? What's going on in my life? You know, I write down what my resentments are in life, and I find the common theme is me.
Yeah.
And I start realizing, you know, the most freeing thing I've ever learned through recovery is that nobody's thinking of me. And it sounds like you're alone, but it's the most freeing shit in the world where you've come.
Yeah, because you know what they're thinking about? Themselves.
100%. And there, you know,
so you're saying it's freeing to realize that you're making up most of what you think other people are thinking.
And there's this like, oh, dude, fuck Sam Tripoli. And there's these meetings, the fuck Sam Tripoli meetings, you know.
Are they
and
part of the conspiracy?
No.
The fuck Sam Tripoli meetings?
No, I wish.
Have you done research on those?
Yeah,
how deep have you done the research?
Nobody gives a fuck. Nobody gives a fuck. Do you want to hear a great story, dude, about how mentally crazy I was? I remember when I moved to LA, I came from Vegas, and Vegas at that time was like its own little island of comedy. Like, it had no interactions.
I have no desire to be part of it.
But as a coming up, you had no clue about the rest of the world. So you were just doing your own thing, and we couldn't get hired at any of the local comedy clubs because they just fly locals in from LA. It was nothing back then. So we couldn't even get up. So we had to do our own thing. So like, when I started doing comedy in LA, I'm in Vegas, there was one open mic every other week.
Right.
And so I started making my own shows, and I got all these different shows. So I had a show every night doing my own thing, hosting my own thing. I come to LA, and I showcase for the Montreal Comedy Festival.
Right.
I don't even know what it is. I just, people like, you got to showcase. I'm like, okay, I'll showcase. And I tap into something that I have now that I didn't have then. And I blow it up. I get, you're going to the Montreal Comedy Festival. I'm like, oh, that's cool. I don't even know what the fuck it is, but I'm going. So I go there, and I'm following Corey Holcomb on stage, who at that time I think was a 20-year vet. I don't even know how old Corey Holcomb is. He could be 1,000 years old at this point, but he was like, he's been doing it forever. Crush, I bomb. I'm in front of this comic, this lady at Fox named Ann Manning, who's a wonderful person. I bombed in front of her, and I am consumed now with getting in front of her and showing her that wasn't me. I'm a better comic than that, and I want to fucking show you how great I am, right?
Yeah.
So for 2 years, I am consumed with getting in front of Ann Manning, showing her that Montreal isn't who I am. I work my ass off. I come back from Montreal dead in the water. Nobody wants to do anything with me. The only person who cared for me was Mitzi Shore. She was the only one that would give me spots, and I was able to work through my shit.
This was what year?
This is like 2001, 2002.
So she's still mentally there for the most
holding
part.
On.
Yeah.
But the Comedy Store isn't what it is then. It is its own way, its own island, where what happened at the Comedy Store stays at the Comedy Store.
Sure, sure.
And nobody gave a fuck.
Back in the day.
Yeah. It was
the Tommy Time. Was that? No, it was Tommy Duncan.
No, it was before Tommy Time.
Was Duncan booking?
It was at the end of Duncan.
Yeah, yeah.
And then we got into Tommy was after that. But nothing, you know, nobody was there. And I was just able to work through this thing. And
she saw you?
I saw her. She hadn't seen me yet. 2 years later, I get a call from Maz Gibrani because I was in this Arabian Nights show after 9/11. It was before 9/11. Mitzi's like, Arab's going to need a voice of comedy, and I'm put together. That's how I got into comedy.
You were doing that pre 9/11?
Yeah.
It was 2000.
Yep.
You were with Maz and Aaron and
Ahmed. And the only reason I got
that
in.
That happened before 9/11?
Yeah.
Wow, trippy.
Right? She's like, you guys, she goes, you guys are going to need a voice soon to fucking, right?
What the fuck?
Right? Crazy.
Yeah. In terms of conspiracy thinking, like, because most of where my conspiracy meltdown happened, I wrote about it in my book, was at the store when I was psychotic on cocaine.
Yeah.
So, like, when trippy stories about the store, they always kind of send me back, like, oh, no.
Yeah.
That's Witchcraft Central over there.
Yeah. Well, 100% chaos. So, it's so funny. I showcase at the Comedy Store.
After Maz called you and said?
Maz and Duncan go, listen, there's a chance for us to get you in at the store.
Yeah.
We're putting together an Arab show. You're Armenian. I'm like, yeah. She's like, I'm like, but that's not Arab. They're like, close enough.
Yeah.
So I remember going up, and it was very interesting because Paul Mooney got me in at the store. I'd done a show at a place called the Hustler Cafe down the street, and I did a joke about how hard it is to be a white guy, and I got off stage. He's like, oh, you ain't white. Use Armenian. And he dropped an N-bomb on me, and I was like, damn, I just got called the N-word by Paul Mooney, dude.
Yeah.
It's like a badge of honor, right? So I'm showcasing. People might not know this about the store, but when you showcase at the store, it was so hard because people would hijack your showcase because they were trying to get spots. So they knew Mitzi would be there, and they would sit down and they would try to talk to her, convince her to give them spots. And you do your set and she wouldn't even listen.
Yeah. So you think that was because they were trying to hijack it?
They were trying to get spot. They knew.
But why would they do that when you're on stage? Was it why?
Because when you're trying to get spots, you don't give a fuck. You're like, that's the one.
So you're just saying when she was in the room,
yes,
people would distract her.
Yes. Right. Well, they would try to get her ear to get spots.
Yeah,
you know, whatever you want to call that, we'll label
it. But it wasn't like, I'm going to fuck Tripoli.
No, it wasn't like, Allah, hijack. No, none of that shit.
Right. No, no. I mean, but they weren't doing it out of spite.
They weren't like, oh, Sam's on stage.
I'm going to, it's time shadows, to talk to her. Yeah.
The shadow people are going to love this. We're going to fuck him right now. So I'm doing my set. Now, Duncan calls me and he goes, okay, this is what you talk about. You do one joke about one of your parents, one joke about your ethnic group, and one joke about your favorite joke. And at a time, it was my bit about Asians on ecstasy.
Yeah.
And the only reason I liked it is because Joey Diaz goes, dog, that's a great bit. So I'm like, okay, I'm going to do that. So I did it. And I start doing my act. I see Paul Mooney sitting down. I'm like, fuck. But I'm just like, screw it. Let's just do the best set we can. So I do it. I get off stage. And I walk up to her. And she's like, great set. I'm like, oh, my God. She listens. She goes, are you Syrian? And like, I'm going to be honest with you, I didn't know what Syrian was. But I'm like, yeah, I'm fucking Syrian, dude. She's like, great. I want you to showcase one more time for Jay Davis's show. So that's how I got picked out. And turned out that Paul Mooney was like, oh, Mitzi, he's really funny. You have to pick him up. He'd be great for the show. So I got picked up at the Comedy Store because of Paul Mooney, right?
Uh-huh.
So for 2 years, I'm just gigging there, right? Maz calls
me. Thinking about Manning.
Ann Manning. And Maz calls me up. Hey, I'm doing a showcase for Ann Manning. Do you want to do it? I'm like, it's time.
It's
time.
Yeah.
Fuck,
I'm
yeah.
strong.
Okay. Yes. Yeah. So I go there and I destroy. And here comes Ann Manning, and I've been waiting for this moment
for two years. Yeah.
She walks up to me. She goes, hey, man, great set. I'm like, oh, my God, thank you. She goes, have you ever been to the Montreal Comedy Festival? I go, what? She goes, have you ever been to Montreal? You do great there. She didn't even remember me.
Yeah.
And that is my mind, like resentments and holding on to resentments.
Yeah.
And that's when I realized over time that I was become my dad holding on to all these resentments for so fucking long.
Well, yeah. And also the idea that, you know, that you had failed and that, you know, you were being judged.
Yeah.
And that they were, that she at least once a day was going like, that Tripoli sucks.
Yeah. Yeah, every day, just throwing a fucking darts into a dartboard
just
with my
even
face.
Casually. Just like you're just sitting there percolating. Boy, I wonder what happened to that guy that tanked.
With her coffee. Just
after
like,
Holcomb.
Tripoli,
That Tripoli guy sure is terrible.
Yeah, fuck him.
That's funny. A lot of mental space. I was the same way. It took a lot of time, a lot of sobriety for that shit to ease up, for me to really realize it, you know, that they're not thinking about you. But I'm the same way. We got a lot to prove.
It's a crazy gig, right?
But okay, so like, so you finished college?
Yeah, I got a degree in psychology, and I always knew I wanted to be a stand-up, but I had to go to college for my parents, so.
And your dad bought the house out there?
He never bought the house, because I don't want to get in business with my dad.
Right.
I love him to death. I just don't want it, because this is not going to end well.
So, you know, you didn't want to know about his fucking shitty past, and you don't want to get into business with him.
I wouldn't say, listen, man. I don't call it a shitty pet. Human being.
No, I get it. Okay, you did, but you didn't want to know too much.
Yeah, I didn't want to get in the mix.
You don't
want to
get in business with
it. Yeah, I don't want to find out how the hot dogs are made. Yeah. You know what I'm saying?
you're one of the hot dogs.
Yeah, I am one of the hot dogs. So I go to college. I have to get a degree. Yeah. At that time, Basic Instinct and Silence of the Lambs are big.
Yeah.
And I see that these guys, they're into psychology, and they could play with people's heads. And I go, I'm going to get a degree in that. I wanted to get a degree in psychology. And that's what I got. I ended up getting a degree in psychology.
Because of Silence of the Lambs and Basic Instinct.
I had to pick something.
but you didn't really want to do it. But you're like, maybe I'll get enough information. So just moving through life, I'll have a jump on these idiots.
Yeah.
Because I'll know how their brains work and I'll be able to fuck with it.
Yeah, yeah. And then I found out like how much education you have to do to become a psychologist. I'm like, I'm out.
Dude. Yeah, but you wanted to get some basic info.
Yeah, yeah.
But you don't remember anything.
Mind games,
you didn't
dog.
Know. But they don't teach you that.
I don't remember doing one fucking ounce of homework. Ever. I know I did.
Yeah. But it's funny to me that you wanted to be a comic your whole life, but your incentive for studying psychology is like, I'm going to get ahead of the curve on this shit.
Yeah.
Like it was self-protecting
yes.
to avoid the treachery of your father's persecution.
I don't
instinct.
Think at that point I was trying to avoiding that I didn't want to get in business with him, but I don't think.
No, but I just mean the state of mind.
Yeah.
It was like, you know, because you didn't know you had it then.
Yeah.
But you were still sort of like, you know, if my dad's right, everyone's out to fuck me.
Yeah,
so
right.
If I can get a jump on that shit.
Yes, yes, completely.
Right.
I want to be able to see signs. And I'm reading books on body language and yeah. shit like that.
Because they're all coming at you,
yeah,
Sam.
Yeah, yeah. 100%, dude. 100. It's been mental warfare from the jump.
Yeah.
Just
yeah.
this thought of like, what is this guy doing? What is
what
that
does he
guy
want from
doing?
Me?
You know?
What is he working? Yeah, yeah, were they yeah, talking yeah. about me over there? Why yeah. is he laughing and looking
100%.
At me?
100%. What are you guys talking about? Oh. Me? You know? Soon everybody's thinking about me. And you
no
know,
one gives
the end
a
day,
fuck.
Yeah, nobody gives a fuck.
Maybe two
so,
people.
My mom. That's about it.
Well, you know, the thing is that you know that because like if you're working a program, so you know that like you there are people thinking about you because you probably did some stupid shit. So like, and then you got to make it right. You got to own your side of it, and you have the tools to do that now. So you know the one, and you know when you know like that. Well, that person is thinking about me because I was a fucking dick.
Yeah,
and I
got to
fucking make that right.
I you know, the cool thing is like as you go through recovery, you learn about making amendments and to people.
Amends
to people.
Yeah.
And
I think amendments is sort of,
yeah,
that might be some of the.
That goes back to conspiracies.
Yeah, it might be,
amends.
Yeah.
And I do enjoy doing that now.
Yeah.
I tend to, at the end of the day, self-reflect on some stuff.
Do it as quick as possible.
And I enjoy it.
Yeah, it's a relief.
Because I'm Armenian, dude. I'm Armenian-Italian. I go zero to felony very quickly. And
yeah.
I react, and then I'm like, oh. That was the wrong reaction.
Yeah.
Well, it's a natural.
So you apologize to your girlfriend a lot.
I mean, we both go crazy on each other, but I think we're at a point where we don't take it personal.
Oh,
you know,
right.
Like
that's
we both have these weird flare-ups.
Right, so it's sort of like, oh, he's doing that thing now.
Yeah, she's doing that. She's yelling at me. She's a crazy person, and we all move on.
Yeah. So when he started doing stand-up in Las Vegas, you had to make your own way. There were no clubs. I can't remember the club. You couldn't get in the hotels.
Well, the clubs that were there, right? There were Catch a Rising Star, the Comedy Stop, the Improv, and Steve Sharippa's comedy club at the Riviera.
Yeah.
And none of them are there anymore. They're all gone.
Right.
And I think only two of them are named different clubs. Now one's the Laugh Factory and one is Brad Garrett's comedy club, which is.
But there was no way to do open mics or nothing.
No, they didn't have open mics. They never had open mics. And this was really when being edgy and dirty wasn't in. You know,
I
like to say you had to be a more cleaner, more mainstream.
Well, as a nobody, but I mean, there were definitely edgier, dirty people doing
Vegas.
Well,
I just didn't want to do any of that. And that to this day is the same way. I just want to be me and I just want to be on. And I've gained the benefits of that, and it's, you know, financially probably hurt me along the lines too.
What,
so,
just being a dirty fuck?
Just being me, dude.
Yeah.
You know, just talking about my shit on stage. You know, I got this bit.
I say dirty fuck nicely. I mean,
I respect that.
Yeah.
I got a bit about the time I smoked crack with this guy, and he tried to suck my dick, and I had to punch him with all my crack strength and run off. And some people don't want to hear about that, you know? But it's just my.
Sounds like a good story.
It is a great story. It's fucking funny as fuck. But some people like.
But that's true because, like, and I was thinking about this the other day about, you know, just even living the life we live with or without drugs is that we are not part of the workforce. So, and that's putting it lightly, right?
Right.
So, and a lot of times, like, a lot of things that we think people relate to, they don't, there's no way they can relate to it.
Right.
So, you know, you've just got to sell it in a way that they're like, holy shit,
that's fucked up.
Yeah.
But, you know, you're not going to get, you know, unless you're at a meeting, no one's going to be like, dude, I know exactly.
Yeah, that, 100%, dude. 100%. There's nothing like doing a good NA meeting, dude.
Yeah. Oh,
you
boy.
Can tell a great story and people just explode.
Oh, yeah. And it's like, I got one for you.
Yeah.
I was the guy that tried to suck you.
Hey, that's you. Yeah, dude, you shouldn't have punched me, bro.
We're all making amends.
Yeah. I do. I just find it. There's so many rules of comedy now. And
is there though, really?
Yeah, there is. I think
really?
There is.
What do you mean? Are they hard rules? Or are they?
I think that, you know, I think there's some
which is cultural expectations.
I think there's also like what people are comfortable with on stage, and you know,
I think that buttons are being. I think there's always a couple of guys that are out there pushing the envelope, and I think that, you know, that there'll be a pushback.
I'm for it. I mean, I want people to love each other and treat everybody with respect, but yeah. I think that we should also be allowed to talk about all the funny things everybody does.
Yeah, and also, yeah, and you know, there's always guys that are going to, you know, be there to be the steam valve, to blow off the steam and take the hit, but usually there's one or two guys. Everyone can't do it.
I'm just like, I love punk rock.
Yeah.
Like, I love going in and fucking just lighting shit up and burning places down, and I don't know, man. I just enjoy it, dude. I like playing weird fucking gigs. Like, can I tell you about the weirdest gig? One of the weirdest gigs I ever did.
Yeah.
I got asked to open up for a cat named Fat Mike from NoFX.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, I know that guy.
Yeah.
I know of him.
He asked me to, his wife is this woman. Her name is Soma Snake Oil, and she's a very famous BDSM mistress.
Uh-huh.
And I got called to do his 50th birthday party, and I talk about this to my act about how like 50 years for a punk rocker is like 1,000 years old.
Yeah.
You know, it's like Gandalf the White Wizard ship.
Yeah.
So I get called, and I go to this it's at a BDSM bar by LAX, because that's all the weird shit goes down is by the airports where business guys can fly in, get weird, get back on a plane, and get the fuck out. And nobody knows who they are. And so I show up, and it's like all like cross dressers and leather daddies. Everybody's in leather or they're cross dressers. And I've been asked to host, you know, and I'm like the guy who did the naughty show and all that shit. And, you know, so I'm kind of like known as a crazy person. But in this room, I'm the most vanilla human being out there.
Yeah.
Like, just like I met a girl who was like, "You're so vanilla." I go, "What?" I'm like, "What are you into? Like, what's crazy?" She had sex with a knife to her throat. Like, this is like legit people.
Yeah.
Like, she's like a lawyer by day, like, you know, a hostage by night. And so I show up, dude, and I do my act. And, dude, I mean, nothing is relatable. And I am bombing, dude.
Oof.
But my saving grace is I get heckled by this guy who looks like a cross-dressing minotaur, okay? Yeah. I look out, and there's this guy with this giant afro. He's got these weird devil horn implants, all black eyes in there with contacts, full beard, and a wedding dress.
Yeah.
And every time one of my jokes bombs, he yells, "I want to fuck you in the ass," and the plate, and then would explode, and then I'd rip him a new asshole.
Yeah.
So at some point, I stopped doing my act
and just waited for him.
And I just start ripping in this guy, talking about how I felt like I was in Narnia and I was about to get fucking prison raped by the Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe.
Yeah.
And it ends up saving my fucking act.
Yeah.
But that's
hands on.
Oh, dude, it's like Bill Burr said: until you're famous, every show is an away game.
Yeah.
And then you become famous and every show is a home game.
Right.
And like, that is, I'm just doing shows.
Just like a survival show.
Yeah.
But what a weird, weird environment.
I just love it though.
Did you host the Porn Awards?
I did something on Showtime called the Sex Awards.
Yeah.
It was the first and only time they did it. It was literally the worst gig I ever did in my life. It was just chaos. And I walked out and I did my shit, and everybody's like, dude, I walked out to a TV gig where everybody on their phones. These are all porn stars.
Yeah.
All coked out of their skulls.
Yeah.
Texting people.
Yeah.
I'm like, who are you texting? You're where it's at. It's where everybody wants.
You're all here.
You're all here. The only joke that did well was like, the biggest winner tonight are the coke dealers, and the place exploded.
Yeah.
After that,
nothing.
Fucking nothing but flatlining.
So you're at the store all these years. Because I remember when I first met you, you were kind of amped up and sweaty. Your hair was slicker. You were thinner. And
who was it?
I know. But at some point, you hit a wall, because I think I was there at the early in your early sobriety, right?
Yes.
What happened? When was that?
You know, man, I talked about this before. It's just like, you know, it became at the Comedy Store where the coke and the sex was more important than the actual performing. And I just realized I can't do that anymore. And it's just like, you know, it's like I said, it's like doing coke is like going to a restaurant, eating.
Yeah.
Like eventually you have to pay your bill.
Yeah.
You have to pay a bill.
Yeah, but like, it's more like, you know, not eating. And not-
yeah, just ordering food and just sitting there.
That's exactly what coke is.
ordering food. And just sitting there, and they're like, you're going to eat it?
I'm like,
okay, I'll eat it eventually. And you just never eat it. But now you got to pay a bill.
That's exactly what it is.
You know? And how bill.
But you didn't eat. I know. I didn't do anything.
I just sat there grinding, trying to get creepy with this young chick who's also not eating, you know? I don't know, man. I have a sex addiction, a really bad one, and coke and sex addictions go hand in hand.
How does that play? How did the sex addiction play out? Just like
girls like to, I mean, like yeah. they like
hookers
coke.
Though and stuff. Or,
no, nah, not hookers,
just,
dude.
You know, just anybody.
No,
who was game.
I once was, you know, I'd get sober and then I'd relapse, and then I would be like, get rid of all the drug dealers in my phone.
Yeah,
and then I'd be like. Oh man, I got to find drugs. And I would drive around, and this is a true story. One time I got robbed by the same hooker twice in one day, dude. Because I was looking for drugs. I was like, fuck. So I'm like, hey, you know where to get drugs? She's like, oh yeah, I know where to get drugs. So I give her the money. She never came back. I'm like, fuck, I got robbed. So I drive around, dude, yeah. Right now. And like 2 hours later, I still haven't found drugs, but I see her. I'm like, no one would do it twice in one day. Nobody's got that lack of humanity, dude. So I picture, she's like, baby, I'm sorry. It just got weird. I couldn't find it. I'm like, okay, just don't do it again.
Yeah.
Give her the money. Yeah. Didn't come back. I'm like, fuck. Yeah. You know, so. Yeah. Another thing that got me off coke is it was just getting so bad. It was so
it's been almost 20 years for me. So I like it's so away from me.
It's so stepped on. It's so bad. So I'm just like, why am I even doing this? It's the worst business model ever. Like coke dealers always fucking over their clients. Like, how do you get repeat business?
Yeah.
Why are you fucking people over? It's like short dollar game.
Because you gave a hooker twice. You got robbed by the same hooker twice.
Hey,
that's
dude,
why.
Live and learn, dude.
But that's why. That answers your question. Like, it's like, they'll come back.
Yeah, you keep
going. You once in a while, you throw in a good batch.
So crazy, dude.
How long has it been?
It's been I'm up 200 days now because I smoked weed, but I'm, you know, but I had 5 years at one point, and now I smoked weed a little while ago, 220.
Oh, so you're back?
Back in the mix.
How long were you out?
Oh, dude. What I do is I get like a year, go out and weed,
yeah.
And then get some time.
Yeah.
And I go back and forth over the last like.
Yeah, weed would be the thing that would take me out because it's so easy
and it's so available.
Yeah, yeah.
I like shrooms too, but I can't do shrooms. I miss shrooms.
Yeah.
I like shrooms. I like to talk to God once in a while.
Yeah. Sure. And what does God have to say? Did he say,
keep rocking, dude. You're doing the Lord's work.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
That's what he says when you're on shrooms.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Now, I got a question. Yeah. Do you think that maybe. Because we sort of established something here. And you know, I'm not a psychiatrist or a psychologist, but I think it's interesting that it seems that there is sort of a theme in, you know, your relationship with your old man in terms of what he's like, and then you realizing what he's like, and then you studying psychology. And it just seems to be a straight line to this researching conspiracy that there's still this sort of preemptive kind of like, I want to be on top of it because they ain't going to fuck me.
Probably. This probably isn't. It probably isn't.
I'm not going to be fucked by any 100%, of this bullshit.
100%, yeah. 100%, dude, without a doubt. I was thinking as I was talking, I'm like, oh, man, that's probably where that all comes from. You know?
Yeah.
And how, like, there is that, but I just enjoy it.
Sure. But what's your dad, what's he up to? He's just hanging out?
He gambles. His girlfriend, he's dating a beautiful black woman who used to dance on Soul Train.
Yeah.
And they just live in Prescott, Arizona. And he just loves his life. He's just, he's always telling me about how he's always working out, yet he loses no weight, which is fine. That's his thing. And he just does his thing. He goes to gamble, loves Golden Corral, and he eats that all day.
Yeah.
And he's just living the life I think he always wanted to do,
which is
not any responsibilities, which is kind of always where I am right now.
Yeah.
I, you know, when I look at my career versus my friends, that's when I get depressed. But when I just look at what I'm doing, I love it. I have no boss. I make good money, doing my own thing, and I fucking love it. I have no masters. I just do my own shit. But when I look at, like, you know, the other people, this, you know, I go, oh, man, I should be doing all that. But when I don't, when I take that out, and I'm just like, man, I'm a dude who flunked first grade. I'm from, my brother was the number one high school bowler. I didn't do jack shit. I was, my only claim to fame in high school was that I was in a breakdancing group called the HDI Breakers, and we were sponsored by the Holiday Inn, and I was most improved on the high school bowling team. That was it. After that, nothing, dog. Nothing. And here I am, just making good money, doing my own shit. You know, I always got told if I was dirty, I wasn't going to make any money.
So, well, that's not true. I mean, like, you know, there's a whole world of, like, you know, guys I came up with. I think I was dirtier when I was younger, but, you know, like,
that's where I am too.
It's like a tell, and there, you know, there's definitely a
the
model
best.
For it.
I love
He's
him.
The best. Yeah, yeah. I could tell that, you know, you're like of the Attell school.
Yeah, for sure. The best writer. The best. I like you too.
Well, thank you. I love Attell too. I wonder how he's doing. Have you talked to him?
I haven't. I mean, when I see him the couple times in New York, anytime the fact that he knows my name is a giant win in my life. You know, he's like one of those guys where you're like, I love that dude so fucking much. And like, he's like, hey, what's up, Triple A? I'm like, oh, fuck, he knows my name. Every time. Every fucking time.
Yeah, I love watching.
You know, him, Rogan, you guys, Burr. I love watching what you guys have done. You know, it's fun to watch. You know, I heard you say one time, and I wanted to know what that meant to you, was that you said, you know, things are going good for you, when, and maybe I'm messing up the quote, but...
Yeah.
When you started doing what everybody else was doing in terms of, like, do you know what I'm saying? Where, like, maybe you were doing it one way and then the successful people were doing it another way.
Yeah.
And then you kind of like, well, maybe I'll try doing it in your own way. Not that you did them,
right.
But you did you, but in their
right.
way.
Yeah.
And I often think maybe I should do that and then, like, start playing the game a little better.
Well, I think what it was really like, I don't know if that, like, what I would do was, it was more about how I was looser in the sense that, like, I would go out of my way to sort of, like, make sure that I was not planned. Like, that like, you know, I knew where I wanted to go most of the time, like, if I'm doing an hour and a half set. But I would kind of wing it, and I would wing it on important things. And I thought that was, like, that was ballsy. And that, you know, then, like, and then you're really taking risks. And then after a certain point, I'm like, yeah, but you've been doing this a long time, and maybe you should structure your shit.
Yes. Yes. Yes.
So it was really, like... Like when I did the Epic special, I'm like, I'm going to have callbacks. I'm going to work this fucking hour and a half, and I'm going to bring it in, you know, right on the money. And I kind of got off on it. I was like, I did the work and I did all the loose work, and there's still, I'm working right up until that day I shoot. Like the last special I did, which is the best thing I've ever done, that two reel.
Isn't that cool?
For Netflix. It's like, I didn't have the ending of that set until the day before. Like,
wow.
I was on the road doing about an hour and a half, and they needed 70 minutes. So I had to cut 20 that last 2 days before I taped. I waited that long, and I just fucking knocked it out. I made a list, got rid of unessential shit, figured out where the callback was, changed the ending, made it stronger, and nailed another callback. And so I just started getting off on that.
Yes.
As opposed to just fucking being punk rock.
The details. Yeah, I'm with you, dude.
That was the change. It wasn't so much like do it the way other people do it. It was just sort of like, I should be a responsible comedian and do my fucking job properly.
Yeah, I'm with you on that too. I'm with you on that. I battle between my punk rockiness and the understanding that these people are here to be entertained. You know?
Yeah, I mean, you know, punk rock can be pretty entertaining, but, like, you know, once you get people who are coming to see you and you realize, like, you know, like, you know,
they're
I should do
fans.
New stuff. Yeah, and you can get loose with them, you know, and they dig it. But you do, you know, it's weird. I'm not always thinking about them or the entertainment thing. I'm really thinking about, like, fuck it, I can do that.
Yeah,
I can. You know, like, you know, if your callback going to make you look like a genius, I can do fucking callbacks.
Yeah, yeah. You ever have a callback? You're like, whoa, that got a big reaction.
They love them every time.
Yeah.
I'm like, I'm like the one I did for Epics. Like both of the last two specials, like two or three callbacks, and I'm like, they just fucking love it because, you know, it's, you know, all of them sort of have a theme, but when you have a callback, it makes it this unified thing. Like, you know, if you call back all the way through an hour, one or two callbacks, it feels like a whole prepare, like it's like a show.
It's a bow. It's not just a package.
Well, no, it's like there's continuity. It's not just a guy telling jokes. You know, like you do a callback at the end, you know, all of a sudden that whole hour and 10 minutes, it's like, oh, it all fit together. Yeah, it's just all perfect. Connected. Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
I'm right there.
It's all connected.
Yeah.
If you want to play ball, it's all connected.
This is your best. That this is the best thing you do, because that's how I feel like kind of as a comedian I am right now, is the best I've ever been.
Yeah.
And I think that's really cool that, you know, I'm about to shoot my special. I'm shooting it at the Viper Room. I just want to do a small venue.
Yeah,
a
I've
rock
done that.
Club,
it's great. Yeah, I did like a 200 seater for Thinky Pain.
I love it, dude. I'm going to put like 150 in each show, do two. And like, I'm kind of putting it all together right now. And I just feel like I'm the best I've ever been. And I think that's kind of amazing, being 20 something years into a career and just being able to feel like you're still getting better.
Yeah. Or just it was finally settling into myself, like to know myself well enough to where I'm not going to drag them through my goddamn problems. Like I can, you know, I have enough distance from my bullshit to where, you know, I can make it funny as opposed to just going in front of audiences and making them pay for whatever fucking, you know, problems I have or however I was brought up.
Yeah, I get that totally.
I mean, that's entertaining, but you know, it's a little exhausting.
Yep.
And it's hard to repeat, and it may not be something people want to see again.
I completely get that. I work really hard on trying to do simple, relatable shit too, because I have such a weird skull.
Yeah.
And I like to go into weirdness.
I've been doing a little of that, and I can feel that. With the thing about going in the weirdness, and especially if you're good at it, which you are, is that, you know, you get way out into the weirdness and you're like, ah, fuck, I left me on an island down there.
Yeah.
Like there, I left Sam sitting on stage. Where the fuck am I?
Yep. And it's just like,
but it's fun to come back. But that's the thing. You can always come back, land again, you know?
I do love that, dude. I love the whole just psychology of it all. Mm. I call my comedy Gator Roll. That's how my style, which is like start really simple at the top and then kind of bring them deep into the waters of chaos, you know? And like, and just psychologically bring them, get them ready for the next level of creepiness so that they're not like, whoa, what the fuck? You know, like, hey, slowly bring them.
But do you leave them in the swamp or do you pull them out at the end?
I think I need to pull them out at the end.
You got to work on that part.
Like I'm trying, because I want to tell the crack smoking story on this special.
Yeah,
but I don't think it could be the end.
Yeah, I had that issue with my last special, that there was a beat where it was just dark, and it wasn't a story, but it was a joke that was pretty existentially dark, even though it was funny. And I'm like, do I really want to end
on
that?
At the end of the day, my whole thing is like, everybody's a little weird. We need to get over, like,
sure,
being creeped out by that. That's my point.
Well, I know, but, you know, being weird and getting over something is still like, you know, you're still talking to regular people who may not have had, you know, a crackhead try to suck their dick on crack.
Right.
So, like,
you know,
they can get over it. It's your life. They have nothing invested in it. But, you know, it doesn't need to be everyone's experience.
What do you mean you never experienced this? You never smoked crack with a robot? I get that is the weird thing, because I don't want people coming here to my shows hearing stuff that they've heard before.
Yeah.
Or that they can come up with.
Yeah.
I want it to be completely unique, but it needs to be relatable, because when it gets too unique, it just becomes, what the fuck are you talking about?
No, but I think that, like, you know, a lot of times just your phrasing, I like when people, if you blow their minds because they never thought of something like that.
Yeah.
Like, I know what you're talking about, but I never thought about it like that.
Yeah.
That's the best you can do.
Yep.
Really. And you can doll that up however you want. I mean, you can, you know, make, you can paint as elaborate a picture as you want. But ultimately, you're sort of like, I know where you started, but I had no idea where you were going there. And I never thought about that like that.
That's where the comedy comes from, the surprise.
Sure. Surprise and just the execution of it.
Yeah.
All right, buddy. Well, I'm glad we did this finally.
Thank you for having me on, dude.
How'd it go for you?
Dude, I had a great time. I don't know how you thought.
No, it was great.
I had a wonderful time.
It was good.
I'm so happy for all your success.
Thanks.
I always have been.
Oh, thanks.
I remember when you just started doing this, we were both working out out the Y together. And I'm like, hey, dude, your podcast is blowing up. I'm super happy for you. And you were like, yeah, dude, I'll have you on. It was
now. When was that? Like, which Y?
30 Hollywood years later, Y? I finally was on it. Yeah, it was at the Hollywood Y. You used to run on the treadmill.
Yeah.
And we used to talk all the time.
That's right.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Why did I could have just put you on then?
No, it's fine.
It's at the beginning.
I think people think I'm a crazy person sometimes.
I don't know. That was never the case. It was really just sort of like, you know, you'd be in my head for a while and then I just forget. I don't think you're crazy. It was no personal judgment at all.
No, yeah,
you know, it's like you were a store guy and I wanted to have you on at the beginning.
Yeah.
But now look, more people listen. It's better.
No, I'm totally thankful for it and I'm super happy for you, dude.
You too, man. That was lively, wasn't it? That was Sam Tripoli. Go to samtripoli.com for all Sam Tripoli info.
Okay, I'll see you in Stockholm tonight. Right? Right? Boomer lives! But it's going to be hard for him to figure out where he comes back. Oh, don't add that. No, go ahead. It makes it sad, though. It's a mythical call.